When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Kia always asks, what makes a house a home? Comfort? Making your place your own? Affordable solutions created with the planet in mind? With IKEA, it's all of the above. And now you can afford even more with new benefits for IKEA family members, including 5% off on all eligible purchases in-store. Every visit, every day. Visit ikea-usa.com/family to learn more and join. Offer valid starting 9/1/2022. Limited to qualifying purchases. Exclusions apply. Not valid on services. Discount applied in-store only before tax, shipping, and handling. Cannot be combined with coupons. Visit ikea-usa.com/family for more details.
Everyone gets AT&T's best deal on the new iPhone 14. So, people currently listening to comedy podcasts, and people listening to self-help podcasts, and people listening to true crime podcasts, who actually can't stop listening to true crime podcasts. The point is, everyone, new and existing customers, ask how to get the new iPhone 14 on us with eligible trade-in. Visit att.com or our stores for details. Terms and restrictions may apply.
Will stood back and held out the knife, searching, touching the air with the most delicate movements, until after a minute or so he found a point at which he could cut. He did it swiftly, opening a window through into the moon-drenched parkland of Chigatse, and then stood back, estimating how many steps it would take him in this world to reach the study and memorizing the direction. Then, without a word, he stepped through and vanished.
Welcome to His Darker Materials, where we run through the BBC HBO show His Dark Materials, episode by episode. Now, here is your spoiler warning. This is to cover season 2, episode 5, so we will be discussing everything from season 1 up to season 2, episode 5, this time around. So if you haven't seen everything up to season 2, episode 5 yet, please go away, watch them, they're fun, come back, and then listen to us discuss them. Go away, be gone. So hello, I'm your host, Helen O'Hara. I'm joined as ever by Dave Corkery.
Hello, Helen.
Hello. And as ever, if you have anything you'd like to say to us, you can get in touch with us. We're on Twitter at Stripped Media UK. We're on Instagram at Stripped Media, and you can use the hashtag His Darker Materials. And this is a really exciting episode this week because we are joined, and you will be hearing some clips from Daphne Keane and Amir Wilson themselves, Lyra and Will, in person. Yes. With us.
Yes.
Except not in person.
Not right now.
No.
Because we were in person with them, except not in person. Oh, this is like Inception. Anyway, we already chatted with them. We had a great chat. We're going to be dropping in some segments from that interview throughout the episode.
Yes, we are. And yeah, they're a lot of fun. So do listen out. But there's a lot to talk about with the episode itself this week. This was another bit of a barnstorm. It really does feel like we're building to the end of the season now.
This is a great episode.
I mean, yeah, really, really good. Shall we start with where the episode starts? Shall we start with Lord Boreal and Mrs. Coulter?
Yeah. So we get, a few episodes ago, we had Lyra entering our world and, you know, almost getting hit by a car and the sort of bewilderment of Oxford. And we kind of get that through Mrs. Coulter's eyes in this episode, which I personally really enjoyed this sort of fish out of water thing. And also, there's a thread throughout of the Ruth Wilson, you know, as is amazing as always, but the way she plays this sort of self-reflection, realization of, or this frustration with how she just grew up in the wrong world. Mm. You know, she's literally looking at what she could have achieved in this world. We start with her a lovely quiet moment in the beginning of this episode where she's watching a mother rock a pram and work on a laptop.
Mm.
You know, very, very...
Multitasking
and worry, exactly. So I can't do that. And then all the way up to later on when she's meets Mary Malone and is shocked that she runs her own department. Mm. And then we get this whole bit later with her unleashing this frustration with Lord Boreal about having to fight for everything, you know, having to have her published works under a man's name.
Yeah.
It's just the sort of unfairness of it all really gets to her, doesn't it?
It really does. And it is interesting to see that. I have often railed on the Empire podcast against giving villains too much motivation, spending too much time on that and not enough on villainy, because I think it is a trope in modern storytelling and cinema. But I will absolutely 110% make an exception for Mrs. Coulter, because she is an incredibly layered, contradictory, complicated character. And I think giving her that kind of context, which is pretty sympathetic, I mean, certainly to most women watching, that's going to be a really, really sympathetic thread for her. You know, does give us a little bit maybe of sympathy for her, which I imagine she'll burn through pretty fast, but it is there. But it also does, you know, give us a bit more understanding of her role in her own world, of her place in the magisterium, of the sort of precariousness of her position, that even someone as an unquestionably brilliant and accomplished and rich, I think, and you know, respected as she is, there is a ceiling on how, a glass ceiling, if you will, on how high she can go. And, you know, it also says, I think, a lot about her. She would rather see her work published, even if it's under another name, because she believes in her own ideas enough to want to do that. It's more important that they be out there than that she gets the credit for them, you know, in the wider world. And she's clearly got a little bit of the credit anyway, because, you know, she does have a certain amount of status that she has clawed and fought for and accomplished. But she clearly doesn't have as much as she should have. I think that's pretty fair.
Yeah. How do you think of the way she speaks to Mary Malone, or the way they interact with each other? Because she describes her in a very interesting way, impertinent and intelligent and free. I think that was a really, really telling word, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And I think there's an element of envy there. I think there's certainly, as regards Lyra, like, she would love to have that kind of easy conversation. I think Mary Malone learned more from Lyra in, you know, two conversations than Mrs. Coulter did in the entire time she had her living in her apartment, because she got Lyra, you know, on the same level. She talked to her as an equal. She shared with her in return, and therefore Lyra trusted her. I mean, partly maybe because the alethiometer told her to, but she just told her the truth in a way that she never trusted Mrs. Coulter. And so there's real envy of that. It's not just her status and her position. But you can see her wanting to connect with Mary Malone as an equal, or perhaps at the very least as someone in the same field, as some kind of peer. Perhaps she wouldn't consider her equal, but she would at least consider her someone who would speak the same language. And yet there's almost an element of hesitation or insecurity from Mrs. Coulter in that scene that we don't often see from her. She isn't quite sure where she stands. She isn't quite sure what this woman knows, how much she knows. And she is really, I think, thrown by how much Lyra's sort of trusted her, confided in her.
Yeah, it's interesting because she is a bit on the back foot with her, isn't she? Which she doesn't like to be.
Because
Mary's got the... You know, she references dark matter and dust, but she almost seems to have a better grasp on it than Mrs. Coulter does. And in many ways, she does, having that that basically voice automated text to voice version of dust. We did skip over one massively important detail, though, Helen.
We did.
Which was the opening shot of this episode, which is the golden monkey wearing a flipping seatbelt.
That
will stick with me for the rest of my life. I don't know why it was, but and I have such conflicting feelings about this bloody golden monkey. And again, during this episode, the same, which I guess is an extension of Mrs. Coulter, as you said, as a character, because, you know, she's this ball of contradiction. But that the golden monkey in this episode alone and throughout these two seasons just veers between horrifying and terrifying and just bloody adorable.
Completely.
And also sympathetic and pity. So him wearing a seatbelt at the beginning of the episode, him being locked in a house.
Well,
later
she
on,
goes
like,
off. Oh, yeah, palm against the window.
Stroking the window. And I'm like, that poor lad. And then Will meets him and it's just like, and I'm just like, ah.
Yeah, it is. I mean, again, it goes to all of her contradictions and her sort of confusion with herself. It's awfully useful that she can separate, because it is hard to imagine quite how she would fare in a college with a monkey walking beside her. Presumably she would have to take a weekend bag instead of Lyra's little, you know, backpack. But yeah, it is, again, it's just testament to her toughness. And you can see that it makes Lord Boreal, he's weird in this episode. He is a little bit, I think there's almost an element of, and this may be overthinking, fetishizing women of this world. And finding it quite exotic that she can turn up looking like them and without her demon visible. And there's almost an air of that being a bit, you know, a bit risque for him, you know. And his face when she comes downstairs on her own without the monkey is something. So I think, I don't know, I think there's
That's
something
interesting.
Going on. Yeah. I mean, he does definitely have a crush on her at the best of times, so it might just be that. But
I mean, yeah, that at the very minimum, he is that. But you're right. That's a really interesting way to put it. And he kind of ties into what we learn about him in this episode in general, which is he's kind of obsessed with our world, which is interesting, because I guess previously the perspective we've had on Boreal is, we don't have a lot, we just get glimpses, but he always seems to be, you know, 10 steps ahead of everyone else. He's very established, well connected, has authority, power, he's secretive
in two worlds as well.
So he has a mastery that crosses worlds. But this episode, when we spend so much time with him, he just really comes across as this like kind of desperate and a bit shallow. He starts this episode in that car with Mrs. Coulter, describing our world as a culture of consumerism, not faith. But he says it in a dismissive way, but it's very clear as the episode goes on, he's been seduced by it. Mm-hmm. You know, showing off all his worldly possessions. Look, there's a piece of the. There's a lot of comedy in this episode, actually. There's a look at this piece of the Berlin Wall, Mrs. Coulter, and she's just like, whatever. But for me, the absolute pinnacle of it all was like kicking back and showing off his speakers to some lighthouse family.
God, I mean, that almost makes me like him more. You're like, God bless you. You think the pinnacle of cool is the Lighthouse Family, because it's probably it's probably what they played you in the showroom when you bought the fancy speakers or something. You know, it does go to his lack of depth. You're right, and it's kind of adorable. But yeah, he does come across as a fanboy of the world rather than a serious scientist in the way that she is. I mean, she's a bit like, if you can do that, why wouldn't you do more with this? This is crazy, you know. And I think there is an element of frustration on her part that he hasn't been more serious about it. Like, she would have been more serious about it. She would have taken over the world already. Like, what is he messing about with living in Oxford?
Exactly.
So yeah, her already, you know, existing but seriously growing contempt for him in this episode is kind of funny, but also kind of sad. Like, he, God bless, he just wants to show off his things and you know, and impress a girl. And
I know it does have this, you're right, he presents a bit like the golden monkey, as a bit of initially a terrifying character, but quite pathetic and a bit sympathetic in this one.
He is
like just trying too hard on this date, which is just the worst date ever. She's barely like containing her, or for someone who's so composed normally, Mrs. Coulter, she's really unable frequently in this episode to disguise her disdain for Lord Boreal. I'm amazed he hasn't picked up on it more.
Yeah,
but I think he's just got laser vision for her, doesn't he? And we learn that, you know, throughout this whole series, the only goal that Lord Boreal has really had this whole time is just wealth and greed, a bit like the guild.
Yeah.
And also just someone to share it with. He's just lonely, yeah. isn't he? He's just a lonely yeah. old dude.
He is, bless him. I mean, not bless him. He's also awful. But yeah, he is lonely. And I think it's interesting the way when he tries to sort of talk to her, you know, and sort of preen a little bit and go, like, Azrael's the first one to travel between worlds. Whatever, dude. I've been doing it for ages. But, you know, yeah. he didn't create his own pathway. He didn't innovate something to get where he is. He didn't, obviously, you know, blow a hole between worlds the way that Azrael did, and he doesn't certainly doesn't have the anything near the scope of the plans that Azrael has. So that attempt to kind of neg her ex was just always going to fall flat for her. She's immediately like, I mean, yeah. no. And that line she has later, you know, if you actually got me, you wouldn't know what to do with me, is that's perfect. That's harsh. I mean, that is,
it's cutting.
You know, yeah, please call the police. There's been a murder. Jeez.
Yeah. And I did like that when, like you say, when he brings up Azrael and she, that's the moment she flips, because she, again, this is just ties into what we were talking about earlier, this, you know, living in a man's shadow.
Yeah.
And she's angry that not only he brought up Azrael and is trying to compare himself to him, but that he brought up Azrael in the context of her talking about herself and trying to explain to him about herself.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Boreal just struck out on every level just here.
Over and over and over again. Yeah. Oh, well. Okay, so that more or less sums up, let's say, Mrs. Coulter and Lord Boreal. What about the real fearsome twosome here, Will and Lyra? Because they have what I think we're going to call a window heist going on.
Yeah.
Which
I like
is
that.
Cutting windows between worlds in order to break in to Lord Boreal's basement fortress of solitude and steal back the alethiometer.
Fortress of solitude. That's perfect.
It kind of is, right?
That's exactly what it is. This is great. This is, I love a heist. I mean, I'm just a sucker for a heist.
Absolutely. Ocean's 2, although, this is.
Exactly. And I love the... I mean, the best bit of a heist is often the sort of prep for the heist, isn't it? The planning stage. So I loved all that. I loved Will and Lyra with their chalkboard blueprints in Chittagati. I said it right
you
for
did.
Once.
You and, got it.
Experimenting with the windows, discovering that our world is just on the other side and they're sort of right on top of each other. And I love this sort of like makeshift sat nav that they've created, like opening a window, peeking in. Yeah, okay, it's just two streets over, that
left,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
Love that. And then this whole idea of just being like the concept of using this knife to like position yourself inside secure locations. And then it's kind of a genius, I think, between them to have come up with that, and really powerful.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it, that his home parallels the Torre degli Angeli. I don't really speak Italian or whatever they speak in Chittagati, but it's a parallel between the two buildings, which is kind of interesting. It goes to his building again being a tower to greed and sort of theft between worlds rather than, you know, the kind of discovery that the knife is meant to be used for. I thought that was a really interesting parallel.
Very good. I hadn't spotted that. Yeah.
Yeah, but it also works out handy because, you know, there's nobody else in the tower. They know they can go there safely, and now they can, at least. And
they'd already built the set.
And they'd already got the set, which is also nice.
Now you're going to hear from Daphne Keane and Amir Wilson, and the chat that me and Helen had with them before the show.
So it's like they set up the wires. It's like guitar strings, basically.
Oh, okay. It's fishing line.
Yeah, fishing line. That's what it is. It's really thin, basically invisible. And the idea in the show is that basically you kind of feel along for these strings in the air. And once you find a string, you can like hook your knife around the string and then it just slices open.
Right.
And it's like basically just like splitting two strings together, taking them apart, and it folds open. And leaves this gate, this window into another world. And it was fun. We got to play with that. I mean, it was cool because obviously Will gets better and better as he goes along, gets easier. It's cool, you know, getting to experiment with Will, you know, not being able to do it at all when he first cuts his fingers, and then at the end, he just really swift with it, quickly slides down, closes it, becomes an expert.
Yeah. It's always good. It's like, it's always good to have that kind of training montage, you know, and then there's usually the training montage, they don't quite get it by the end of it, but, you know, the mentor or whoever is kind of satisfied and goes off and does whatever else they do. Or
cuts off
in
and
this
dies
case.
In a horrible day.
Dies in this case, okay. but then there's the kind of like mastering the techniques afterwards. So, you know, I guess the window heist, if that's what we're calling it, is a great example of, you know, just practicing until you get it really, really good. It's, it's awesome. That isn't the only thing that Will and Lyra do there, because they also, as they're racing around trying to find their way into the right bit of our world, they also come across, is it Tonio, and see his sister's devastation, Angelica's devastation, at what has happened because of them.
Yes, this was quite sad.
Mm.
Bella Ramsey really getting to flex her muscles here. And what I thought was interesting about this was the anger on display from her and the kids and the threat that now presents. Mm. But what was interesting was what we get from Will and Lyra then is them kind of having this discussion about the ramifications of their actions, right? And the consequences. And, you know, I think Will says he doesn't want to hurt anyone else, no matter what they've done, because bless both of them, they're both real sensitive souls, and they've been exposed to a lot of murder and death at such a young age without ever really meaning to cause it.
I think that's it's again another key little moment or key little detail of his character, that he, you know, has this, if you like, history of violence that he has. You know, we saw him, I think, for the first time in the boxing ring. You know, we saw him learning to stand up for himself to bullies, that he has anger in him as well, that he would lash out at people sometimes, but that he doesn't want to. And I think that's really, really important, that he is keen to be better, be more controlled, be gentler and kinder and everything else. And I think that's the real Will actually coming through. It's not just it's the anger of his circumstances and the anger of the pain that he's been through, but it's not necessarily his innate nature. It's a really lovely little beat in the show, even though it's, as you say, really, really sad for the poor old boy.
And it really actually lays the foundations for his fight with Boreal later. Because there's a real the fear in Will is potent, and I think largely, well, because it's a naturally scary situation anyway, but it's also the fear of hurting this man, because he knows he kind of has the upper hand with
the
this
knife,
impenetrable weapon, right? He could hurt and kill that man very easily, but he doesn't want to. He's very much stay back, stay away. I will break your precious things if you come anywhere near me.
He's fighting the man and himself. Like, he's scared not just that this man might hurt me, but this man might force me to hurt him. You know, he's got you coming and going, really. It's really tough.
Do you know what? He made a fatal flaw in that moment, though. He picked up the wrong object. If he had found the Lighthouse Family CD collection...
that would have got him.
Things would have gone differently.
So differently. and it is interesting what makes Will, because we're just skipping ahead a bit, but what makes Will actually kind of lose that restraint and kind of go for it is goading by Boreal, first of all, but it is goading about his mother. It is not the threat to himself that sets him off. It is the threat to someone he loves that is the real, you know, thing that does it. And I think that, again, speaks to his caring side and his compassion for others.
Let's talk a bit about the window heist, maybe, because you mentioned at the top that that was one of your favourite sequences to film. How, you know, how was it? Well, how was it all that all put together? And was it, how long did that take in that house set?
That was actually like a few days, that whole like sequence. Well, I mean, because obviously they were shot in two bits. There was like, Daphne and Ruth's bit.
I can't remember my name. He's known me for more than a year now.
It's been a very long day. It's already late afternoon.
Long day. Yeah. there was Lyra and Mrs. Coulter's bet, and then there was obviously Will and Lord Boreal's bet, and that was kind of, they were kind of shot separately. But obviously there's a bit before where Will sneaks in before Lyra comes down the stairs. That's what I felt like I was on that set for a long time, but that was probably one of my favorite sets. Other than Chittagatse, that was actually my favorite set. It had a really cool like astronaut. It was like a museum basically. Yeah. You've obviously seen it. And it had like an astronaut suit. It had like all these like bits of the Berlin Wall on it as well, inside it, in these like glass cabinets. Really, really cool.
Yeah, what would you take from the set if you could?
Fun fact. Wait, one second. Oh, yeah. Amir, the day he had the scene with Ruth, we carpooled like on the way back to work, and he was like, I'm going to ditch you. I've made it in life. I'm working with Ruth, not with you anymore. just going to remind you that.
I mean, that's fair. I feel like any of us meeting Ruth Wilson would be the same way to anybody in our lives. It's like, I'm sorry, yeah. You're not Bye. My friend anymore. Now I'm hanging out with Ruth Wilson, so sorry. So what would you take from those cabinets if you could? What would be your souvenir from the set? I'm not saying
the skeleton, the like weird... There was like this ancient person skeleton. Oh, yeah, I don't even know what it was, but it was like...
a Neanderthal or something,
yeah,
wasn't
exactly.
It?
Like I would have taken the caveman skeleton. Awesome. I would just imagine having that in your house. That would be so sick. So weird, but space sick.
Suit. Definitely the space suit.
Yeah, space suit. Yeah. I think I'd be the space suit as well.
Just wear it around the house.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Cash.
If you're listening to this podcast, you must recognize the value of asking questions. At Aramco, our questions help us engineer a better future. How can today's resources fuel our shared tomorrow? How can we deliver energy to a world that can't stop? How can we deliver one of the fuels of the future? How can we sow curiosity to harvest ingenuity? To learn more about how innovation drives us forward, visit aramco.com/poweredbyhow.
Everyone gets AT&T's best deal on the new iPhone 14. So, people currently listening to comedy podcasts, and people listening to self-help podcasts, and people listening to true crime podcasts, who actually can't stop listening to true crime podcasts. The point is, everyone, new and existing customers, ask how to get the new iPhone 14 on us with eligible trade-in. Visit att.com or our stores for details. Terms and restrictions may apply.
IKEA always asks, what makes a house a home? Comfort? Making your place your own? Affordable solutions created with the planet in mind? With IKEA, it's all of the above. And now you can afford even more with new benefits for IKEA family members, including 5% off on all eligible purchases in-store. Every visit, every day. Visit ikea-usa.com/family to learn more and join. Offer valid starting 9/1/2022. Limited to qualifying purchases. Exclusions apply. Not valid on services. Discount applied in-store only before tax, shipping, and handling. Cannot be combined with coupons. Visit ikea-usa.com/family for more details.
Okay, so let's skip back in time a bit because, you know, we've talked about Will and his reactions, but obviously we have to, let's talk about how he actually gets in the room first. So he and Lyra spy out the lie of the land. They see that it's not just Lord Boreal, that he's there, but they have to get him out of the room in order to be able to kind of grab the alethiometer. So the plan is... Lyra's going to go to the front door, knock at the front door, be a distraction. He's going to go up and answer the door. Will will nip out through the hole in the basement, grab the alethiometer, bing, bang, bosh, job done. It's a
Pretty
really
good plan.
There's just one variable they're not aware of at that point. And that's Mrs. Coulter and the golden monkey, both of whom are in the room when Will cuts his way through and sneaks in behind the sofa. Whoops.
Yeah. This is a great scene. It's very tense. Like, I think it's very, very well put together. And the that moment, that real, like, this show does horror beats really well, doesn't it? Like, that monkey jumping out as Will reaches for the alethiometer just got me good. And the and there was a lovely little touch after that where Mrs. Coulter then comes out and Will says to her something like, watch out, he's vicious, or something like watch out, there's a crazy monkey here, lady.
And she just looks at him very flatly at that point, like, I mean, you have no idea. You have
so
no
good.
Idea, kid. And then Boreal, of course, then brings Lyra in, very firmly locks the door behind him, and all seems lost for our heroes. But, you know, like Ocean's 11, you know, just because you're locked in the vault doesn't mean much unless they can keep you there. So,
nice.
That's the problem.
If only they had a snake launcher in Ocean's 11, like Lord Boreal seems to have up his sleeve. See when he like fires his demon at will.
Awesome, and also I do not want that. No, thank you. Yeah, that was. I mean, that would freak you out, and that would absolutely, understandably freak Will out. But the real fight here, I think, is actually not between Boreal and Will, because you know, and it is a good fight scene. You know, the much bigger man kind of holding the little boy. But the boy against the wall. But the real fight, I think, is Lyra versus Mrs. Coulter. In particular, their demons rematch. And the difference in Pan this time between the fight, you know, so he was in his sort of weasel or stoat form last time. The golden monkey just pinned him immediately, kept him down. It was a vicious takedown, and it was immediate, quick, surgical, no messing about. This time, Pan is a wolverine, literally a wolverine, I think. Mm. And it's just a much, much tougher match. There is real anger here, and you know, and that all that frustration and all the pain of Roger's fate and everything that Lyra's been through, I think, really comes out in Pan in that moment.
Yeah, 100%. And it also feels like an inverse of that scene that you mentioned with the demons' first fight in the first season. And they choreographed it very similarly, which I liked. Like that Lyra does the same thing Mrs. Coulter did in season one, this sort of like quick lunge forward, almost like, you know, this almost like this command to your demon to pounce, and Pan does the pounce that the monkey did. And it felt that kind of, you know, Lyra speaks to it after the fact when she's talking to Will about how she, she's saying, "I'm nothing like you," when she's actually is acting exactly like her, and she's not comfortable with that. And so I thought, and then again, that all ties into them speaking about like their attitudes towards violence and not wanting to hurt people. And it is this incredibly mature sort of conversation and decision by both of them to sort of step away.
Absolutely.
From that.
And I think it's both of them to an extent stepping away from what they've been taught to be. You know, Lyra learned that fight technique from her mother in exactly the same situation, and she tried to replicate what her mother did with some success. And she therefore, she's kind of conscious, it's a conscious rejection. It's not just a sort of instinctive, "I don't approve of you." It's a, "I have tried being like you and that ain't me, and I don't want to be that person." And I think that's the same kind of decision that Will's making. "I've tried going that way. I don't want to be that person." And so you're right, maturity is the word. It's a really key moment, I think, for both of them in this story, that they're both consciously rejecting a way they've been told to be, a way that they've been told is the way to do things. And they're like, "No, we're going to find something else."
Yeah.
Really lovely, actually.
Daphne, was it nice to be reunited with Ruth again for an intense mother-daughter fight scene?
Oh, it was lovely. It was actually, we really, really enjoyed it. I mean, we had a great time with it. We went pretty crazy. I think they probably, we had a great time. It was just, she's so amazing, she's so talented, so lovely, really fun. Also, it was so cool because we got to hang, it was like four of us, and the four of us get on so well.
Right.
So it was just that we just had a great time those days, and then it was so weird because we'd walk in and it was extremely intense, and we were like crying and screaming, and then Aaron and Amir were like fighting, and then we'd go off to the tents and we were literally like doing the Boreal, like Boreal adverts that
Aaron
made us do.
Aaron, you know, L'Oreal, you're worth it. He made everyone, and when I mean everyone, I do mean everyone.
Everyone
members,
set.
Cast. Yeah, Boreal, you're worth it. And that was a painful time.
I mean, that's an irresistible pun, though. I understand why he would do it. I do.
That is,
but he really milked it. It went on for a really long time. It wasn't just a one day thing. It went on for like ages.
Everyone knew it was happening.
Well, how were your fight scenes, Amir, with him? Because, you know, it was one of those moments where you like, you suddenly really did realize, like, this is a half-grown person fighting, like, this big guy, you know? He seemed really outmatched for a second there.
Yeah, it was cool. And it's fun. I get along, me and Arian get along really well. And it was good. So I could tell him, like, he could go harder on me and it'd be right. fine. And, like, it felt like we'd be able to do that and, like, kind of push the limits and kind of have fun with it. And it was really good. I got to smash a vase over his back, which is really fun. They were going to get the stunty. And then Arian was like, I want to do it. And I was like, I want Arian to do it as well. And then, yes, there was like this clay, you see at the end, and I smashed it over his back. It was fun. We had a really good time doing that.
How many takes did that take?
I think they were running out of vase. I think we did it in like three.
Three phases.
And each time I got harder and harder, yeah.
I love that, they're running out of vases. What about, and Daphne, you got the sort of demon match rematch, you know, between Pan and the Nameless Monkey.
Nameless Monkey. It was, honestly, it was so fun to film because it's not just physical, which it is, because obviously even if you're not fighting with your own body, you are actually fighting because you're feeling all of the pain and like all the strain and stuff. But what was really, really fun about it, I'd say, was just the fact that interesting duality that Lyra has in that scene where she's going, I'm not like you, and yet she's doing exactly what her mother does. Mm. And you can see she's enjoying it, but she's hating herself for enjoying it. And that's what she says later on to Will. Like, she just, it doesn't feel okay, but it is a human instinct we have. When you have rage, you just react like that. It's natural and it's horrible. And it was just so raw. And it was just so fun to do. Especially, it's an honor doing it with Ruth because she's just incredible.
Please tell me there's footage of the two demon puppets fighting each other on
set. Oh my god, yes, there is.
You know, I was just about to say that. I said that was my favourite part, watching the demons and the puppeteers just running about. It's like smacking the
puppets. It's really funny because then you see me and Ruth being like extremely emotional, like crying, screaming. And then I remember at one point, one of Pan's legs fell off and I just got the worst giggles ever. And when you get the giggles and you associate it to the line you're saying, so every time you say the line you get the giggles, it was not a good moment, but we made it, so it's fine.
Well, another moment that really stood out to me in this episode was actually Boreal's demon. There's a moment when he's first heading to Will and he like launches his demon out of his...
No, stop.
that was fun. I mean, because Arian actually had a real
Sean,
snake for
it was
Arian.
Called Sean. It pissed
Sean,
on me
that's
once.
His name.
Sean the snake.
Oh no.
Sean pissed on Daphne once.
Oh wow.
Not good.
But obviously, for that bit, they didn't actually bring the snake out. I would have run off. I would have actually just gone out.
They weren't just firing snakes.
No one would have blamed you.
Yeah. Where's Amir? Yeah. Gone.
Yeah. And that was cool. Liam was like, Amir, like, scream. And I was like, every time the snake would have to come out, it was fun.
Did you get to touch the snake, Amir?
I never did. I saw it. I never got to touch it.
He doesn't dare.
Actually, no, I did. That's a lie. I held it on set once. Sure. On that set.
Mm. On that. It's mucky. It's mucky. It peed on me. I do not like the snake.
I never think about snakes peeing on people.
I did not until it peed on me. And now I never holding snake.
Think about nothing else. Yeah.
Because they got to pee.
I guess. Somebody once brought goats into our office to promote a movie, and after that, all animal visits were banned. So don't have goats. Don't work with goats. Don't That's my
goats.
Top tip.
Goats are dicks. Yeah.
Goats. Don't like goats.
We had a dog on season one on set, and the dog got fired because it kept smiling into the camera. It's quite funny.
How can you fire a dog for smiling into a camera?
It was so sweet. It was like this really... It was this scene with like the scholars and stuff, and then everyone was being really intense about talking about dust and stuff, and the dog was just like, which is like not appropriate. So
breach
dog
of contract.
Got fired.
Lord Boreal and Mrs. Coulter have their own sort of resolution to take afterwards, don't they?
Yeah. So I thought it was really interesting how they both react to, you know, losing. essentially, which is not, you know, neither of them are used to that. Boreal is defeated. He seems really deflated. I don't think he loses much. He's somebody who has, unlike Mrs. Coulter, I think life has kind of come easier for him. Now he's smart enough and, you know, calculating enough to seize the advantage when he needs it. And but Coulter is somebody who fought tooth and nail to get to the same level as him, and has lost, you know, a lot, and lost a lot personally. So she is no stranger to failure, and it only strengthens her resolve, doesn't it? And she's sitting there, kind of seething, but also a bit sort of calm, and you know, saying we'll get our chance. And then as soon as she hears about the specters and dust, you know, she makes the connection. Yeah. This is the scientist in her. You know, because I think Boreal mentions offhand that the specters don't hurt children. And then she's like, and the cogs turn. Yeah. And suddenly there's this, you know, she's kicking back into gear. And it's like this, again, with this sense of like threat with her. Like, what is she planning?
I think it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think to an extent she has let him think he's in charge until that point. Even when she insisted on going into town, she framed it very much as, well, they might come back, so you need to stay here. But it was framed like a discussion. It was framed like it was partly his call. And I think here the tables have really turned, and she's like, okay, here's what we're going to do. I think this is really her moment, or one of her many moments, because she doesn't lack for those.
She is just one of the greatest villains ever written, and Ruth Wilson is just smashing it. Like,
absolutely.
I can't get over this character. She's incredible.
She's amazing. But back in Lyra's world, the Magisterium still exists. They're still trotting along as best they can without her, and obviously almost immediately getting into trouble because, you know, They don't have a Mrs. Coulter to turn to. They don't have anyone with quite that firm a hand on the tiller. And in particular, Cardinal MacPhail, this time, you know, things seem to be turning against him. His big initiative was action, not words, against the witches. And what do you know, that really backfired when the witches literally fired back. So
yeah,
it's not a good day to be the Cardinal, it feels like, initially.
No, this is an interesting scene because we're seeing him post seizing power and without Mrs. Coulter, and he presents as kind of indecisive, doesn't he? And, and we're seeing him again up against his rival, Father Graves, who's kind of seems like he's got more authority in this room. You know, he's getting letters delivered to him.
Yeah.
You know, which I think is a bit of a slight. It felt like, you know, he's getting he's part of the information flow. Even though it was interesting because Graves feels like he is not railing against Cardinal MacPhail. Like he's
undermining. He's being kind of snarky, though, isn't he?
Your strategy
isn't working. We need something else, you know.
Yeah.
Hence, the Cardinal lashes out completely disproportionately and has him hold off.
Yeah,
for
I know, right?
Okay, then.
I think I was like real. Like I was getting Donald Trump vibes here. It just felt like if someone in your cabinet disagrees with you, then they're out.
Mm.
You know, that kind of thing. In my way or the highway.
So, yeah, so he accuses his rival of, you know, basically having a lack of faith. It's a lack of devotion among our ranks that is the problem here. It's the classic, you know, it's just you're just not believing hard enough in Brexit. In the authority. And that's why things are going wrong. And I think it's exactly that here. So this is a tragedy. This tragedy is not a setback. It's a sign, is what he says. So, you know, Graves is carted off. Sorry about that, dude. But, you know, that's the way it's going to go. But the real meat of the Magisterium scenes, I think, here comes a little bit later when he talks to Fra Pavel, who's his best alethiometer reader. And he's looking for answers on Lyra. And that's really interesting. So he's fixed rather more on her and not just on Mrs. Coulter.
Except that we've seen Fra Pavel and his alethiometer skills in action, and they're leave a bit to be desired.
Yeah, they're slower and more limited, but, you know, there's still an alethiometer involved, so they've got to be reckoned with, I suppose. Yeah.
Speaking of serpents and slithery demon types, turns out that Mary Malone... is a serpent.
Yes. And I wonder about, I wonder what we're meant to take from that, because, you know, the serpent is knowledge, self-awareness, not just sin, potentially. So serpent isn't necessarily as negative as it sounds, or as we may take it, having been raised maybe in a Judeo-Christian tradition and seeing lots of magisterian people in this story with snake or reptile demons, you know, we might be inclined to distrust serpents, but maybe not is I think the message here, because if Mary's one, then that makes you reconsider, at least makes me reconsider.
Better be careful here, Helen. This sounds like heresy.
Oh no, cart me
they
off.
They might be listening. I do like they're going, you know, Philip Pullman does this naturally as well, but the Mary picks up her Bible, and this is very, you know, this is biblical references.
Yeah.
The serpent is crafty is what she picks up in this episode, isn't it? And you're right, it doesn't, you know, it means it's offering, you know, what was it, Adam and Eve, the serpent offers temptation, don't they, but it is attributed with the dawn of humanity in many ways, isn't it, or current humanity.
Yeah, it's sin. Maybe we were talking Star Trek before we started, sorry guys, that's the kind of geeks we are, but we were talking Star Trek and they talk a lot about sentient species in Star Trek, and that's for many people what puts humanity aside from other species on this planet. We are sentient, we are aware of ourselves, we have self-knowledge, and that maybe is what the serpent gave us, that maybe is what the serpent represents. But craftiness is a pretty great explanation as well, let's be honest, and she's going to have to be crafty if she gets through, if she wants to go and do what she's going to do. She has to be crafty to get past the Guardian, or, you know, the Night Watchman.
She's going to have to create some paper mache and get some stencils out, and
very crafty, yeah, like some glitter glue even. I mean,
yeah.
It's nearly Christmas, she can get stuff going.
She's gonna craft a disguise for herself to get past this dude.
No, the other kind of crafts, I think, the other kind of craftiness.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah, I think so. But
she does deceive the Guardian.
She does.
Nonetheless, she is crafty, and she takes her first steps into Chitty chitty bang bang.
Chitigatse. She does, and I'm very pleased. It was only on watching this episode a second time that I sort of picked up on the fact that they do say you will be protected. Because for a moment there, I was a bit like, I'd kind of forgotten the book, or I'd forgotten this part of the book for some reason, and just was like, but she can't. It's not safe. But she will be protected. So that is some kind of comfort.
I love where your Northern Irish accent really came out there when you're scared. Is that when it happens?
I guess so. Yeah. Otherwise, I have to focus on the letter R, and then I can sort of bring it back a wee bit. Anyway.
Very good.
But yeah, so I love it also that she has this weird, you know, dust, angel dust, if you like, that she talks to through her computer. But her first call is still Google.
Yeah, I know, right? Mrs. Coulter, I guess that's where we would all go. Yeah,
but
yeah, I know, right? Like, ask the computer lady. Yeah,
it's got to be there. but yeah, and then her work in that world is finished. It's time to go, and she just, you know, she has a chat with her sister first, in fairness, and then she just goes.
Yeah.
Fair play.
See ya.
Bye.
For some reason, I want to start singing "Into the Unknown" from Frozen 2, but I feel like Disney might sue us. Will the Catholic Church shut this podcast down before Disney sue us? That's the big question. That's the cliffhanger for this week.
That is,
folks.
If you will, the unknown.
Hey.
All right. Well, on that note, with both the Catholic Church and Disney terrifyingly coming after us, I think that wraps it up for this week. Do come back for the penultimate episode of season 2 next week. We are already there. OMG.
Yes. And we'll hear more from Daphne Keane and Amir Wilson next week as well.
His Darker Materials is a Stripped Media production. Our executive producers are Kobe Omanaka and Tom Wally. The episode was edited, mixed, and sound designed by Tom Wally. This episode was produced by Helen O'Hara and Dave Corkery. All our music was composed by John Dix.
Our artwork was created by Sam Gilby. And the excerpt read at the top of the show was taken from the book The Subtle Knife by Philip Pullman and published by Scholastic. This episode was recorded remotely in parallel worlds. Finally, big thank you to James Carroll and the team at Northbank Talent Management.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.
Everyone gets AT&T's best deal on the new iPhone 14. So, people currently listening to comedy podcasts, and people listening to self-help podcasts, and people listening to true crime podcasts, who actually can't stop listening to true crime podcasts. The point is, everyone, new and existing customers, ask how to get the new iPhone 14 on us with eligible trade-in. Visit att.com or our stores for details. Terms and restrictions may apply.
IKEA always asks, what makes a house a home? Comfort? Making your place your own? Affordable solutions created with the planet in mind? With IKEA, it's all of the above. And now you can afford even more with new benefits for IKEA family members, including 5% off on all eligible purchases in-store. Every visit, every day. Visit ikea-usa.com/family to learn more and join. Offer valid starting 9/1/2022. Limited to qualifying purchases. Exclusions apply. Not valid on services. Discount applied in-store only before tax, shipping, and handling. Cannot be combined with coupons. Visit ikea-usa.com/family for more details.
Hey, listener. Have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Whatever you love to talk about, we know there are listeners out there who will love to hear it. Whether you're an expert, a super fan, or just want to speak your mind, start sharing your passion with a podcast and your audience will follow. With Acast, it couldn't be easier to get started. You can create, launch, grow, and make money across all listening apps, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. There are listeners out there for every type of podcast, so let's hear it. Head over to acast.com to get started for free.